Welcome to the Veterinary Financial Podcast, where we discuss financial freedom and whole life success. I'm Meredith Jones, a veterinarian and financial planner.
And I'm Willie Bidot, a lab animal specialist and a money nerd.
This episode is sponsored by Care Credit, the popular third-party payment provider. They are also supporters of the Veterinary Financial Summit. Visit carecredit.com to learn more. Hey, Willie, want to do another roundtable episode?
Let's do it.
All right. So we published a blog recently by Dr. Phil Zeltzman, who is a co-founder of Veterinary Financial Summit. And the blog was called, What Financial Advice Would You Give Your Younger Self? So he interviewed some of the best minds in veterinary medicine about what advice they would have given themselves knowing what they know now. So let's expand on some of the ideas and the takeaways from the blog.
That's a great question. You know, what financial advice? And it comes at a great time. I've been reviewing quite a few contracts. And I feel like the most I do is give basic financial advice to veterinarians. And that is, you know, people that are going into a specialty or even graduating from vet school. And let's go ahead and use the template from that blog post and kind of break it down for what you and I think. So it starts off with saving. And I guess whatever saving means to you. One question that I do see in different financial Facebook groups is, what high yield savings account are you using? And for those of you that are not using one, most brick and mortar banks do not have a good interest rate or yield on your savings. So most of these are online banks. I personally use Ally. That's the one that has worked for me. It's completely online, but I haven't had an issue in 4 years that I've had them. I've never had to go to a bank for anything, thank God. So yeah, what about you, Meredith?
So we started out with a Betterment high yield savings account, but then when the bank shutdown started happening early last year, we opened an Ally account. And so I think one of the good things about Ally is you can take one high yield savings account and break it up into different buckets, like a travel fund, emergency fund, and things like that. So I like it for that reason.
Yeah. And, you know, high yield can mean different things to different people. In my aspect, you know, I was getting 0.1%, which is what I think brick and mortar banks are offering right now for savings account. And right now, I think Ally is about 4% or a little bit more. So again, it gives you a good return on your money. And you mentioned emergency fund. Can you expand on that?
Yes, emergency fund. So what I like to talk about for either young folks starting out or really any of the kind of basic personal finance lectures is I like to talk about two different levels of emergency fund. And so if you're just starting out with getting an emergency fund going, I'd say the first level of emergency fund is about $3,000 to $5,000. And so if you think about it, that'll take care of the majority of simple emergencies that may come up. And then your next level up from that is to save 3 to 6 months of expenses.
Yeah, and that usually a 3 to 6 months, from what I've heard, is depending on your job security mostly, you know, how secure is whatever you're doing to make money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if you're single, then you may be more likely to lean toward 6 months of savings. If you have one person in the household who maybe their job isn't as secure as the average veterinarian, if you have a spouse or significant other who has a job in a different industry, then you might also be leaning toward 6 months of expenses. If you have two folks in a couple who are in a really stable job situation, then you may only decide to have about 3 months of expenses saved.
And me personally, I've always kind of shoot for the 6 months, but recently for some reason, I'm shooting to have 12 months. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just, I want to have the capability of saying, hey, I could go traveling for a year and nothing's going to happen, you know, no impact to, well, except for that fund. There's really no impact to my life. You know, I can keep paying everything that I'm paying. So again, you play around it. You can be more conservative, more aggressive.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And in my savings, I like to automate everything. So you know, when I talk to people, they're frustrated because they don't know how much they should be spending or how much they should be saving. And me personally, fortunately, you know, I'm a vet, my wife's a vet, we make a good salary. So for me, once money hits my account, usually that's money that I can spend because I have put money into investments, saving accounts, and whatnot. So I know that whatever is hitting my checking account, that is money that I can go all out and do whatever I want with it. But I feel like automation is your friend. It's something that everybody should be having in their life.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
And then, you know, after savings, which I think, you know, an emergency fund is about the most important things when starting to learn about finances and trying to get your finances together. And Meredith, you can stop me whenever because you give financial advice as a career. So so you might be better fit to mention if that's your first kind of point whenever you start the finance talk.
Yeah. One of the first things that we ask, and we ask it in our questionnaire before they even have their first meeting, is we ask them how much do they have in their checking and savings accounts, and try to get an idea of, do they have an emergency fund in place yet, or is it something that they're going to need to build up as a foundation?
Again, I consider that to be a very important aspect of your personal finances. Another aspect, you know, I feel like this is, you can work on this when you're in vet school, even before when you're an undergrad, and then after you graduate, you probably would be using a lot is your credit. So, you know, it's sometimes difficult to build. So thinking about it from the get-go is ideal. And there's many different ways to build your credit. A common one is a credit card. So, you know, if you can get a credit card when you're an undergrad, be it by a cosigner like your parents, loans, you know, I wouldn't recommend people to get more loans on the student debt loans, but I think, Meredith, you had told me when we were offline about a strategy to build some credit with loans.
Oh, yeah. This is something that I heard from one of my undergrad professors way back when I took a personal finance course back when I was a freshman. And he was talking about building credit and saying, oh, well, you know, if you take out a small personal loan, so not a student loan, but like a personal loan, and you pay it off in full in a short period of time, that can help to build your credit. And it goes on, like, if you think about how a credit score is calculated, a lot of it is really your payment history and do you make payments on time? That's like 35% of your credit score. But they also look at having different credit types, which honestly, for most veterinarians and vet students, they're going to have student loans. And so they're already going to have loans and then also have revolving credit, which is credit cards.
Yep. And again, when we're talking about loans and credit cards, it's, you know, you have to be responsible with them. When I say credit cards, which for those who know me, I love playing the credit card point game. I have plenty of credit cards. None of them have a balance. I pay them off every month. So I would never, never pay interest in a credit card. And also another thing that I think it's becoming a little bit more popular or more known is rent. So it used to be, you know, you send a check to somebody, you pay your rent. You can't really build any credit out of that. But I have a credit card, which I can pay rent with it. So they'll send a check to my landlord. And again, that's a credit card. So I'm building credit on my rent. I think also I was reading recently that Zillow is starting to come with an interface so that, you know, people can pay rate through Zillow and they also build credit that way. So again, there's different ways to build credit, even if you're just starting off.
All right. So let's transition into talking about investing and saving for retirement. And so one of the tips that we want to make sure that we cover as far as financial advice you would give to your younger self. So definitely going ahead and getting a Roth IRA started as young as possible would be on my list and something that I personally did not do when I was younger. How about you, Willie?
I did not do it when I was younger. Unfortunately, it was when I started learning what investing was, when I was actually making money, that I heard of this magical Roth IRA. And I was able to max it, I think, the past 4 years. But now, unfortunately, I'm over the income limit to put directly to my Roth IRA, which leads me to something that I'm not really familiar with. But if you follow a few financial blogs, they'll talk about the backdoor Roth IRA. Meredith, do you know much about that? Because I certainly don't.
Yes, yes, I do. And so let's back up a little bit and make sure we're covering why a Roth IRA is a good investment to begin with. So definitely when we think about a traditional 401k that your job may have, or Willie's going to talk about 403bs here in a moment that are similar. So your traditional 401k, those contributions to that retirement plan are all pre-tax contributions. So it's coming off the top of your paycheck before you actually receive it. And then when you retire, you have to pay taxes on that money when you take it out in retirement. For the Roth IRA, you pay taxes on the money to begin with. And so then what you have is that grows over time. So between now and retirement, I've got this growth in the Roth IRA. Then when I pull it out in retirement, I've already paid taxes up front and I don't have to pay any tax on what I put in or on the gains in the account when I am using it in retirement. And so there are advantages to having some of both. That's why we talk about Roth IRAs being a really good investment, because we don't really know what the tax brackets are going to be like when we retire. You know, we don't know if they're going to be higher or lower. And there are arguments either direction for trying to project what you think they might be. But a short answer might be that you could consider having some money in both types of accounts so that you have different buckets of money to choose from. For the backdoor Roth IRA, so two categories of veterinarians that this would apply to. One would be folks who are above the income limits. And so for single folks in 2024, the Roth IRA starts to phase out at $146,000 and it phases out completely at $161,000. For married folks who are filing their taxes jointly in 2024, the Roth IRA starts to phase out at $230,000 and then it phases out completely at $240,000. So if you make above really any of those numbers that I just said, then you're probably looking at doing a backdoor Roth IRA. The second category of veterinarians who are likely to use the backdoor Roth IRA strategy are those who are married but filing their taxes separately because of student loans. So if you are going for income-driven repayment and if you have determined that it's going to be less expensive for you on the student loan side and it balances out well on the tax side as well, if you are in that category where you could benefit from married filing separately to reduce your student loan payment, you would also be in a category where you would be contributing to a backdoor Roth IRA instead, even if you don't meet those higher income limits that I was talking about. So with a backdoor Roth IRA, what you're doing is instead of putting money from your bank account directly into the Roth IRA, you are opening a traditional IRA as well as a Roth IRA. And by the way, anybody can do this. So you can open it up with Vanguard, you can open it up with Fidelity, you can work with a financial advisor. This is something completely separate from your employer's retirement plan. So with the backdoor method, what you would do is you would contribute money directly to the traditional IRA, and then you do some extra paperwork and get it converted over and transferred from the traditional IRA to the Roth IRA. They call it a backdoor because you're not going directly. You're kind of going in through a backdoor method that is a legal method. Some people think that it may be something where the loophole for being able to do a backdoor Roth IRA might actually close at some point if the regulations change. And so that's another thought too, is you might want to do it while you can.
Yeah. And again, I think the powerful thing about the Roth word is you already paid taxes on this money. So let's say an example, me, I'm 36 years old. I'm going to retire 20 some years from now. At least that's about the retirement age. If I pay taxes now, I'm pretty sure I'm saving money because I know tax brackets are going to keep going up. So by the time I'm 60, the tax bracket might be extremely high. So now I have this account that the money's pretty much mine. I just have to reach retirement age and then I can take it out fully. So it's a huge benefit. With that said, you know, there's also a Roth and traditional for your employer retirement accounts. So, you know, I always refer to them as 403b because I've been in academia for so long, but a 401k. So a 401k or 403b, that's the 401ks of nonprofits or government agencies. So that would be your employer accounts where you can save money for retirement. And some of them allow you to do Roth contributions. So meaning, hey, let's pay taxes now and you don't have to pay taxes in the future. Traditionally, you do the traditional route where you put money, you save on taxes, and you'll pay taxes once you are retirement age, which might be a good strategy because you're hoping that at retirement age, your salary on quotations is extremely low. So you might be on a low tax bracket. But, you know, rules of thumb for 401ks is please, you know, contribute enough to hit the match. If your company offers a match, please do so. I do understand, I've seen enough contracts to know that some matches are not really easy to comprehend. Like, you know, we'll match 33% of your first 6%. And it's like, once you calculate, it's like, oh, so you're matching actually like 2%. But you have to put that 6% to get that 2%. So it's I know it's difficult, but make sure if it says of your 6%, of your 5%, go up to that 5 or 6% because they're pretty much offering you free money. Any other tips on the 401k?
Yes. So another thought, because of course I'm always thinking about student loans, is with the 401k and 403b, the traditional side of those accounts, if you are contributing money on the traditional side, then that's going to reduce your adjusted gross income. And therefore, it's going to reduce your taxes. And because it reduces your adjusted gross income, your student loan payment, if you're on an income-driven repayment plan, is actually going to be lower as well. So there's an argument for if you have student loans for contributing more money to the traditional side of the 401k or 403b.
And, you know, now talking about IRAs and 401ks, I had a call yesterday, you know, going through contracts. And this was a person that is going to become a specialist. And she asked me about Roth IRAs. And I thought, you know, why are you asking that? And unfortunately, I had to tell her, well, with the salary that you're being offered, you're going to be outside of, you know, the traditional way of putting into a Roth IRA. You can certainly do the backdoor Roth IRA, but I told her you should have considered that while you were in residency, while you were making a small income, you could have put money directly to a Roth IRA. So again, for those of you that are doing residency or vets that still haven't hit that income limit, make sure you're putting to Roth IRA. The other thing with 401ks is this person is getting a sign-on bonus. And I always tell people when you're getting a sign-on bonus, that's going to have a huge tax liability. So first question is, how do I pay less taxes? So I mentioned, well, I think this year you should max out your 401k. You know, that would decrease your tax liability, which I think it's $22,500 this year, 2024. So again, you know, you have to think, okay, I'm getting a lump sum of money. Don't go spending it. There's ways to save money. Again, not even in just retirement, but like Meredith mentioned, maybe for your student loans in the future, that might be helpful to save that money elsewhere.
So we are at the three bucket strategy. We have talked about the Roth IRA. We have talked about the 401k. And so veterinary salaries have increased over the last few years, haven't they, Willie?
Massively. Yes.
Yes. And so I am seeing more and more veterinarians, including some of the folks that I work with, who have higher salaries. So whether it's as a single person or whether it's as a household, they may be at a point where they are maxing out Roth IRA, maxing out their 401k, and they're still not at their savings rate. So maybe they're trying to save 15% of their income, 20% of their income, etc. If they're still not at their savings rate, then they're looking for another bucket to put money into to save for retirement and perhaps even save for early retirement. And so for those people, the third bucket is often a brokerage account. And so a brokerage account is a non-retirement investment account. It also happens to be the same type of account that we talk about using for the tax bomb at the end of income-driven repayment for folks who are using that strategy for their student loans. So the third bucket being a brokerage account.
That is a great way to put it, because I have people that, you know, have been hearing podcasts, reading books, and then they ask me about this magical brokerage account. And I'm like, wait, rewind. Do you have a Roth IRA? Are you putting money into your 401k? You know, if the answer is yes and yes, then okay, let's talk about a brokerage account. Otherwise, please get those two together, and then we can go ahead and save in a brokerage account. And it also depends on your goals. You can certainly use a brokerage account for something that we're going to talk about soon with our student loan subject. So the other investing component that I wanted to talk about is real estate. Phil mentions that he wishes he had learned about alternative investing sooner. Again, I'm not familiar with others like cryptocurrency and whatnot. So, you know, I'm just going to say real estate is a very powerful way to invest. We recently talked about Airbnbs and having different properties and how you can be financially independent because of those investment strategies.
Yeah, it's amazing. And so definitely if you're looking at the alternative strategy, probably also having some of the traditional strategy going on at the same time. And Willie, you had just touched on brokerage account and we had mentioned tax bomb. So let's back up a little bit more and let's talk more about student loans, because I do think as we're talking about younger folks in this podcast, I do think it's really, really important for a lot of folks. The top stressor for them, whether it's on the financial side or just in life in general, is their student loans. And so having a clear plan and a clear path and a strategy for your student loans, it's so worthwhile. And I think it's going to be something that if you are intentional about, okay, I'm going to go down a specific route, whether I'm going to meet with somebody or whether I'm going to run simulations on my own or whether I'm going to go on the Venn message board, you know, however you do it, having a route to have a clear student loan plan is really important. The top two mistakes that I see, and this is not just with young folks, but one is saying, okay, I'm going for forgiveness and I'm using an income-driven repayment plan, but whenever I get extra money, I just throw it on the debt. Folks who are doing that are wasting their money. So that's the top mistake that I see. If you are going for forgiveness, then use your money for something else and maximize that forgiveness and put the money toward another financial goal. Another mistake I see is not filing your taxes married filing separately when you should be doing that. It's not for everybody. So if you've got incomes that are very, very different, I mean, like one person in the couple's making $30,000 and another one's making $250,000. In that case, maybe you're not looking at married filing separately. But a lot of folks who have two folks in a couple who have incomes that are in the ballpark of being close to each other, a lot of those people are going to be looking at married filing separately for their taxes so that they can save money on their student loan payments. Certainly consult either a student loan professional or a tax professional to get that sorted out. It does also make a difference if you live in a community property state versus not. Community property state like California or Texas, or there's a number of others. For those folks, sometimes even if they have very, very different incomes, it may benefit them even more to file their taxes separately. So it depends on your state. It depends on your individual situation. But a lot of people are leaving money on the table and paying more than they have to, Willie.
Yeah. And again, for those of you that don't know, Meredith is a student loan professional. But those two last points that you talked about, you know, I have a strategy and it's on the income-driven repayment strategy. And you had told me, hey, you know, because of the mess ups from the servicers, if you made any payments in November and December, you can ask for that money back. And it still counts for the payment count. And I did it. Again, my plan is to go for forgiveness. So I wasn't going to leave money on the table. I grabbed that money back. And the other not filing taxes, merit filing separately, my wife and I have student loans. So per my strategy, I can still file with my wife because of that aspect, because both of us have student loans. But certainly if at some point, one of us only have student loans, that we need to consider the filing separately. You kind of mentioned it, but I want to talk about the strategies or how to tackle your student loans. So there's pretty much two ways, but one of them kind of expands in different subjects that make it a little bit complicated. So there's the paying off your loan, which means that you're going to pay it off. The government thinks of that as a 10-year plan. But if you're paying them off, you should be as aggressive as possible because you don't want to pay more interest than you should. You know, that's one strategy. Again, I consider that everybody should talk to a student loan professional and ask them what is their best strategy for their situation. And the second one is one of these income-driven repayments. That's only if you have federal loans. And we have talked about this plenty of times in the podcast, and we have resources for it. But within income-driven repayment, there's different strategies within it. So there's a new one called SAFE that the new administration brought up, and you might be hearing a lot about it from your servicer. But again, you have to educate yourself on what options you have for your repayments.
Yeah, absolutely. And coming back to what you were saying about asking your loan servicer for a refund, just to clarify, so those refunds are available for people whose loans were on administrative forbearance. So if you were on administrative forbearance with your student loans and you made a payment anyway, those are the folks who are eligible for a refund. And that covers a lot of people who are going for public service loan forgiveness and have MOHELA as a servicer, by the way, but also some of the other loan servicers as well. And so if you are one of the many folks who just never had administrative forbearance, but just their payments started just like clockwork, just like expected, those folks can't get a refund.
And talking about the public service loan forgiveness, so that's the forgiveness that I'm seeking, which is if I work for a government agency or nonprofit entity, my loans get completely forgiven within 10 years of making payments. But if you are in one of the income-driven repayment plans, you have some sort of forgiveness in quotations, but you will have to pay what is called a tax bomb. What is a tax bomb and how do you save for it, Meredith?
So the tax bomb is a tax bill or a tax implication that is due at the end of the 20 to 25 year timeframe for income-driven repayment. So yeah, Willie doesn't have to save for a tax bomb because he's going for public service loan forgiveness, but the vast majority of veterinarians who are going for forgiveness are on that longer term kind of forgiveness. And so at least for right now, we have to plan for this tax bomb. And so what happens is the year of forgiveness, you have to pay taxes on the amount of student debt that is forgiven at that time. And so it's based on whatever your tax rate is at that point. So definitely another reason to consider a student loan consult, because they will be able to estimate for you how much to save for the tax bomb. And the calculator that Student Loan Planner uses is great for that.
And you know, you mentioned I don't have to save for it, but just in case, I am actually saving for it. So even that, I'm so conservative that I have 1.5 years left on PSLF. And I still am saving for the tax bomb just in case something happens and I have to continue with a regular 20, 25 year plan.
Oh, yeah. And we touched on this before, but a great way to save for the tax bomb is to use a brokerage account. So one of those non-retirement investment accounts. So you can open one up yourself on one of the major custodian websites like Fidelity or Vanguard, or you can work with a financial advisor and have them open it up and manage it for you. So a couple different ways to save for the tax bomb. And yeah, estimating that amount, definitely a student loan consult is the best way to get an estimate for that amount. I've seen veterinarians who had to save $300 a month. I've also seen vets who maybe they've been out for a while, but they haven't started their tax bomb savings yet, and they would have to save $1,200 a month in order to have the amount that they need for the tax bomb on time. Now, we all hope the tax bomb goes away and that it's not going to be a thing. And what we do know is that between now and the end of 2025, anybody who has their loans forgiven, which is honestly not going to be that many people on long-term forgiveness plans, but certainly there are smaller amounts of forgiveness that are happening even after 10 years for like people who never borrowed more than $12,000, for example. A lot of folks are having their loans forgiven if they're in that situation. And so they're not having to pay the tax bomb. And so all they have to do is extend that and say, okay, we're going to just continue to extend that so that nobody has to pay the tax bomb. And then there may not be one. Or it may be that at some point in the future, some politician is going to come in and save the day and there won't be a tax bomb. But in the meantime, we'll have to plan for it.
With the information that we have right now, you have to plan for it.
Yes. Yes.
So you got this student loans. Hopefully now you can start a great career as a veterinarian. And that is another aspect of, you know, I would have wished I told myself when I was younger, this, this, and that. And one of the things is contracts, which, again, I've been in academia most of my life, so my contracts have been pretty straightforward. But I've been fortunate to review many contracts for vet students or people in residencies going to a specialty. And there's a lot of pitfalls. If you don't read it, if you don't understand that, you can make a lot of mistakes. One big one that has become a shiny object is the sign-on bonuses. Clearly, if somebody's offering you $200,000 in sign-on bonus, it means that there's something wrong with the company or something wrong with the clinic that you're going into. But my issue with them, and again, Meredith and I have talked about this before, is people kind of understand what a non-compete is. And you're starting to see them being removed from contracts. And there's some states that actually don't allow non-competes like California. What they're doing is using sign-on bonuses as pretty much a non-compete. So an example is you get $100,000 for staying at a clinic for 2 years. Well, they're going to give you that $100,000 usually in your first paycheck. If you are 6 months in, 12 months in, and you hate your job and you want to quit, they're going to say, that's fine, you can quit, but you got to give us back the $100,000, which I am 100% sure that you're not going to have because you already spent it. So that's a way to keep you for 2 years. So again, even if it looks shiny, you know, make sure you understand it, make sure it's prorated. That's definitely some language that you want to see. You know, of course, I'm all about getting $100,000, $200,000, $500,000, but make sure it's prorated and you understand the terms on that sign-on bonus. The other pitfall, which I kind of alluded to, was non-competes. So some people just think it's part of the contract. It doesn't have to be. And if they are persistent and they say it has to be, make sure, again, you understand it. You know, I'm going to give this example because it was a person going to work at Manhattan and had a 50-mile radius in their non-compete. I'm like, in New York, in Manhattan? You can't work on the city. You can't work on the city anywhere. Like, that's just, I don't know, that's not feasible. Like, you know, you understand that. This person actually didn't care because they're like, you know, I don't think I'm going to stay long in New York. But still, like, if that's where you want to end up, that could hinder you massively if you ever were to leave the company. So yeah, any other major pitfalls, Meredith?
Those are the biggest ones. I mean, definitely make sure that you understand how your production is calculated before you sign a contract. And there are some contracts that will have negative accrual where, let's say, you don't produce as much as the practice is really expecting you to, then you have to produce that much more to kind of make up for it before you would be eligible for a bonus in the future. So that's something to just keep in mind as you're looking at contracts as well. Another reference is just looking back at episode 32, where we talked about tips for job seekers in more detail.
Yes. Again, I'm really passionate about contracts. So we did a podcast pretty much breaking down a contract and, you know, talking about these pitfalls. But that one's a good one, not understanding your compensation or at least your salary. A lot of people actually don't understand sometimes what the production means in the specific clinic that they're applying to. And another thing, you know, hopefully at some point in life, if this is what you want, you can become a practice owner. In most cases for a practice owner, that is their biggest investment, which is great because, you know, you're in the business, you can see the business grow, and it is usually a great investment. But you should also diversify. That should not be your only investment. And unfortunately, I've seen several vets that they come to an end of their career and that was their only investment. And maybe, you know, they can't sell the clinic and hopefully they'll sell it at some point, but it's not what they envisioned. They didn't have a plan for that clinic. So again, make sure you have other investments.
Yeah, and practice ownership, I mean, it's definitely for folks who are interested in it, it's definitely a great opportunity to pursue. And definitely one of the things that I do talk about when I'm out speaking is don't let student debt get in the way. If you want to be a practice owner, student debt should not get in the way of that, especially because we have the income-driven repayment plans out there. And some folks are actually using that strategically to free up cash flow so that they've got that down payment for the practice or they've got that cash flow that the bank is kind of looking for when they evaluate you as a future practice owner. And if you think about it, a practice that is successful, so a well-run practice that is financially successful, is going to have a higher rate of return than what you would get out in the stock market on average.
Yeah. And with that, you know, I'm going to get a little bit philosophical, but I feel like you have to intentionally save for your future. And this is my motto, pretty much. You spend on what you enjoy. And with Tua, I've seen very positive mindsets with that. You know, I have a good friend that he was good at about saving. He was able to quit his job because he wanted to spend time with his kid. And, you know, that was what was important to him. For me, I like to travel. So I'm spending all my money on traveling in the future. What about you, Meredith? What do you like?
I also love traveling. And yeah, getting back into that, not as often as Willie travels, but getting back into it more now post-COVID. But yeah, I'm definitely on board with aligning your money with what's most important to you.
Yeah, I have 4 international trips coming up just this year. I'm very excited.
That's very exciting. I can't wait to hear about your trips, Willie. And if you do any travel hacking, I want to see a blog. So
you might see it. There's a trip coming up that up to now I'm going there and back and the hotels and everything. And it's to Europe and I haven't paid a dime. So,
whoa. So we'll see. All right. Yeah. That sounds like a future blog in the works. Okay. So coming back to the career side of things. So one of the things, and this is just kind of my philosophy, but when I think about, okay, how can you really set yourself up for success financially and in your career? One of the things that I mentioned, it's actually in the blog, is using your CE money, so your continuing education money that your practice is probably providing for you each year, use it to learn new skills. And so a lot of us, and I've done this myself, fall into just going to lectures, not necessarily signing up for a wet lab or a course that's going to teach you something very specific like global fast ultrasound or like putting hours toward a fear-free certification or taking something like a surgery course or a ER skills and procedures course. There's lots of different courses out there, and you can actually target your CE money to learn new skills, and it'll actually make you potentially a happier associate, but then also make you a more productive associate as well. And then the other thing that I think is helpful to think of with continuing education is I also think it's really important and helpful to, especially if it's something that you're interested in, whether you want to be a practice owner, whether you want to be a leader in your practice of any sort, a 10CE that is business or leadership focused. And there are actually some niche conferences out there that are focused on leadership or business or innovation in the veterinary field. So look out for those. And then the other thing that I'm big on this is making financial education part of your continuing education. So stay tuned for an upcoming episode where we are going to talk about financial resources for vets, right, Willie?
Yeah, that's a question that, again, things that pop up frequently is like people asking the free vets group, hey, what resources are you using? And certainly we are excited to share that with you.
Yeah, I'm excited about that one. So keep a lookout for that in the next couple of months. And for this one, we'll put a link to the blog on financial advice for your younger self in the show notes. And thanks for listening. And we'll be back with another roundtable episode soon.
Yeah, thank you. We will love your feedback. If you're enjoying these roundtable episodes, please give us feedback by sending us a message or rating us in Spotify or Apple.
If you liked this episode, click the follow or subscribe button. Until next time, take care and continue your path to financial success.
The information provided in this podcast is for informational purposes only. It should not be considered legal or financial advice. Consult with a legal or financial professional before making any investment decisions.